Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power.
Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good.
Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Real Madrid against Chelsea getting underway at 8 o'clock. Miguel Delaney from the London Independent is with us. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Joe.
How you doing? So backdrop is interesting here, isn't it? Off the pitch as much as on the pitch. Oh, to have Perez and Abramovich in the same room somehow this evening. Opposite ends of the Big 12 spectrum, these two.
Yeah, very much so. Although, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, I did a piece this morning on Perez and the whole media industrial complex around him and the level of power he has in Spain. And while he doesn't outright own Madrid, Real Madrid, he has basically, the statutes have been changed, so he is essentially the only possible candidate as owner. And many people in Spain would literally describe him as an oligarch. So, I mean, yeah, different ends of the spectrum in terms of ownership, yet a few common threads, right down to ownership of the clubs, and even, from what we hear, the running of the teams and understanding of football. I mean, you know, they've obviously both had certain fixations throughout their times as a owner/president. Abramovich has actually always wanted a Barcelona style of play, not to sound like that famous meme. But to Abramovich, basically, a Barcelona style of play is essentially just like overhead kicks and lovely goals. And it's pretty much the same with Florentino Perez from everything you hear around him. He just likes... I can't believe I'm going to say this, really, but for a 74-year-old man who's been in football as long as he has and presided over multiple European Cup-winning teams, as someone put it to me today, it's almost like a 10-year-old's understanding of the game, where it's basically just, I want all of my stars out there and I want them in the same team. And it has been problematic for some Real Madrid managers. And there's often the theory that they've actually won multiple European Cups in spite of him rather than because of his ownership.
They also differ, of course, in their attitude to the European Super League, it would seem. Perez is still adamant this thing is going ahead one way or another. He's talking about binding contracts. There is a desperation, obviously, about certain clubs financially, whereas it would seem Chelsea were lukewarm to begin with, happy to go along and see where things went along with Man City, first to bail. So quite different when it comes to European Super League as well. I suspect Perez is not well disposed to how they've bailed.
Yeah, totally. In fact, I had a few people mentioning to me today and I was doing this piece. It'd be very interesting to see what the interactions would be like in the Madrid box. Now, of course, usually if it was in normal times, that'd be the presidential box at the Bernabeu, which is described as one of the most powerful places in Spain because it's where Spanish businessmen, international businessmen, heads of multinationals go and deals are literally struck. You know, it's where Perez and the club derive so much power from. But you're right. And I think it's not just that they pulled out, but also that Chelsea were one of the first to pull out. But I mean, there's also, I suppose, there's a different perspective here in terms of how they run the clubs, the reason they run the clubs, and also the motivation behind the Super League. Whereas, I mean, Abramovich, I mean, I suppose some of this is about it's a rich man's plaything. It's about Abramovich having an asset in London like that. And also, I suppose it's about his own personal image. Whereas it is about, and that's one thing that's come up a lot as regards Chelsea and some of the reasons they've pulled out. Now, the most obvious reason was that this thing was never really going to get off the ground because of the amount of legal functional obstacles. But there was also the immense backlash and Abramovich has obviously, he's cultivated a program over the past few years where it's all about been about Chelsea and the community and the good name of the club. And it was someone at Chelsea that used the term to be toxic endeavor. Whereas Perez is almost coming from the complete opposite perspective. He doesn't feel he has to please anyone. And this, the current situation and what you talk about there is where he still has this notion that the Super League is going to go ahead. You know, Alexander Sheffern rightly called him a flat earther in that way. But this is ultimately a man that's no one says no to him. Mm. And that's true, like, in terms of the Spanish media, right up to the hierarchy, if you want to use that term, at Madrid, because really his word goes.
Mm. As you said, you were writing about this today in the London Independent. It was very interesting. And Perez is no fool. His company employs 200,000 people in 60 different countries. It turns over 100 million euro per day. So it is huge, to say the least. That point you made about the presidential box at the Bernabeu almost being the epicenter of Spanish business and politics and sport and international business. Perez's role in all that, is he, you know, on the phone to whoever he wants? Is to what, like, is his business empire founded on his Real Madrid position, and vice versa? Like, all of this stuff feels like it intersects in a huge way.
Oh yeah, I'd say it's more all self-fulfilling and self-perpetuating rather than being one necessarily dependent on the other. And because there are really kind of it's an interconnected web here. I mean, I suppose I go into that piece. I suppose this is how interesting the Super League story is, because of the amount of different strands it goes down and what it brings in. But Perez is a very specific product and expression of Spanish political and economic culture, which is basically after the war and after the end of the Franco dictatorship, there was a conscious effort to rebuild the Spanish economy on three pillars, which are basically the service industry, international tourism, and entertainment, which basically made football, the banks, and particularly the construction industry huge pillar stones in this. Mm. And basically, Perez has been involved in all three: politics earlier in his career, then onto the he's an engineer by trade, then the construction industry, and then onto Real Madrid, with the three interweaving in so many ways. And of course, so much of it goes back when all this sort of discussion is referenced. So much of it goes back to that, I suppose, first massive deal he made as Real Madrid president back in 2001. Not the Figo or Zidane purchases, but in order to fund that initial Galactico program, he sold Madrid's original training ground to the state, so that the state could build a new commercial center. But of course, so that was ended up being worth about 500 million to Real Madrid. But which company got a lot of the contracts for that commercial center? Well, ACS, Perez's company. Mm. So you can see all this interlinks, and even if you want to go even deeper, even with this, say with the Super League, JP Morgan, of course, putting up some or a lot of the financing, we don't know exactly, but JP Morgan were also responsible for financing the overhaul of the Bernabeu. But then I say there might have been other financing. There's been a lot of reports and links about Saudi Arabia's public investment fund potentially financing the Super League. And of course, again, some of that comes back to Perez's construction world contracts, given that his company has again been given the deal to build a kind of Las Vegas-style entertainment city in Saudi Arabia.
Right. That sounds wonderful. We'll get to matters on the pitch. One last point you mentioned, which is kind of interesting in all this as well, is the Spanish media. So Marca, I would have thought they were beholden to Madrid, but it was interesting they had super ridicule on their front page about this whole European Super League endeavour. But AS, is it AS or AS? I only ever read it. It is actually AS. AS. Okay, AS. Okay.
Not swearing on live radio.
Yeah, appropriately enough, AS on their website are so beholden to Madrid that they had headlines like Barcelona are criticised in England, sat next to things like Florentino has been courageous. So some fairly shameless, quote-unquote, media over there as well. I know that's nothing new, but even with this, it's kind of striking, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's comic book stuff. Yeah. Now, I mean, some of this is like it's a kind of a classic power dynamic with the case of with some of the media and some of the radio stations as well. Perez doesn't even really need to make a call. Some of them, they're so dependent on access to Madrid, and because Madrid is such an industrial complex in itself, that it's almost like, from what I've heard, it's almost like a lot of things will be written because they think it'll align with the president's view. But then on the other side, I know of many stories of journalists in Spain, local journalists, telling foreign journalists based in Spain or those over for Champions League games or whatever, you know, please continue with the criticism because you can say what we can't. And funny, which actually did remind me of when at some Manchester United press conferences when some of the local journalists would ask a foreign journalist to ask Alex Ferguson something. But so essentially this whole media complex grown up around Madrid and Perez, where again he faces very little criticism. And like even that second day of the Super League, say, so it was the Monday, which is one of the longest days I've ever had in work, but like I finally sat down, finished at about midnight, then I saw on Twitter that Perez was on this football magazine show called Chiringuito, yeah, which basically means Barca, and it's quite notorious in Spain and considered quite tacky. And as someone in Spain said to me, you know, this is kind of the level we're dealing with in terms of, you know, the intellectual thinking behind the Super League, that this is where Perez is essentially selling his big idea. I mean, he was in a very belligerent mood and essentially, and in a lot of cases, just relaying a lot of untruths. And as I said in that piece as well, from what I heard, there were a lot of Premier League clubs at that point as well. They're almost aghast at what he was doing. Like, this is not how you sell a hugely controversial idea.
Yeah, no, absolutely. To matters on the field then, Madrid with home advantage this evening. They seem to have matched Chelsea up formation-wise. Varane is back in the centre of defence. Still no Sergio Ramos in there. Carvajal and Marcelo are the wing-backs, of course. It's Modric and Casemiro and Cruz who are nearing 1,000 combined appearances for Madrid. And then it's Benzema and Vinicius, who really impressed, I think, against Liverpool, certainly in the first leg, are the two up front. As for Chelsea, Christensen, Thiago Silva and Rudiger, the back three, Azpilicueta and Chilwell, the wing backs, Kante and Jorginho, Kante playing very well lately, and then Mount and Pulisic in behind Werner, who did score recently and also had a horror miss and kind of laughed about it afterwards. And I guess you could take that in a good way, that he's not overly stressed, but he's still not overly impressing either. But it's Werner who gets the nod up front for Chelsea this evening. I would be right in saying you thought Madrid ahead of the Liverpool game were at their poorest in a long time. Are you rethinking that now?
I still think now, I suppose, I think the line I used was it's the poorest Madrid since the 1970s. And some of this, of course, is relative for Real Madrid, because even in the 1970s, they were winning repeat Spanish titles. And I think they got to one European Cup semi-final at least. So, I mean, again, that's relative to Madrid. Hmm. But I still kind of said, I've watched a lot of their league games as well since the Liverpool game. They're still just not that convincing. There's something missing about them. And I do wonder, it has to be said, they did raise it in that Liverpool game. And it was an intensity about them, particularly Vinicius. But also, I suppose, in these sort of games, it really is about how both sides come up against each other. And as good as Madrid were in that first leg, Liverpool were really poor. What ended up being one of the most decisive elements, which is all the more shocking given it's Liverpool, was that there was basically an exclusion zone around Toni Kroos. Now, like, any Liverpool team between 2017 and 2020 under Klopp, they would have basically hounded him until he'd lost the ball. That was something that was so striking about it. And this Chelsea, they're obviously not at the level that Liverpool were for most of that period, but they've got a lot of potential. And currently they feel just a kind of a more competent team without being spectacular yet. And my thinking ahead of the game would be that they're just a bit too composed and have a bit too much about them, that they're kind of a more calculated side. But then again, I suppose as we've pretty much been saying for the last few years, or even the last 40 years, this is Madrid in the Champions League, the European Cup, and they do just have that capacity to raise it. And of course, just I suppose to bring this full circle, it's one of the things that has struck me with the last week as well, and that was such a pity. I mean, why Madrid were so willing to abandon this competition, because when you think of the European Cup, you think of kind of classic matches against Real Madrid. Even going back to the Busby Babes and the Real Tragedy competition, it was a match against Real Madrid that that gave a certain evocativeness to the Busby Babes a year before the Munich air disaster. And with these Champions League games tonight, it's not a contextless game between two super clubs, a kind of flat occasion that so many Super League games would have. It's built on 66 years of history, so every moment is kind of enriched by that. And that's what playing Real Madrid means, and, you know, kind of what they can draw on occasions like this.
Yeah. Have you got a leaning either way, strong one for this semi-final over the two legs?
I'm going to go Chelsea to win, I'll say, what, 3-2 on aggregate. And I'm going to go for Paris Saint-Germain on the other leg, actually.
Right, okay, very good.
Maybe that's what we'll tomorrow.
Well, listen, feed up, enjoy. Thanks, Emil.
Cheers, Joe.
Cheers. Miguel Delaney there of the London Independent with us. Our football coverage is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. We have Ken Doherty on the way after 8 o'clock, by the way.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Hey, welcome along. So we're up and running in the second half over in Madrid, where it's lashing rain, been bucketing rain for most of this game. Second half has just started. Real Madrid 1, Chelsea 1. Later on in the football show, we'll be over to Miami to hear about the Phil Neville, David Beckham dynasty MLS season getting underway. Phil Neville taking charge of his first game. We'll be talking Arsenal in a moment. If you're just tuning in on Real Madrid, Chelsea, Chelsea started this game so well. Utterly dominant for the first 25 minutes. Seemed to have extra men at all times. Options on the ball. Very organised and comfortable in defence. And Timo Werner should have put them 1-0 up. It was gilt-edged as gilt-edged could be, his miss. Three, four yards out, rather. And just, I think, owing to a lack of confidence, instead of tucking the ball away into one of the two corners, he went central and Thibaut Courtois saved it with his foot, and it looked like Chelsea would live to regret that. As things transpired, though, Pulisic put them 1-0 up maybe just 2 minutes later. A ball over the top, really good ball over the top from Rudiger, I think it was. And Pulisic got onto it, went around the keeper, and tucked it away really nicely. So that was Chelsea 1-0 up, and they were looking really good, really comfortable. And sort of out of nothing, not to do Madrid a complete disservice, but sort of out of nothing, they broke. Chelsea had been in possession of their half. They broke, won a corner. Corner was swung in, headed away. Cross came back in again. It was flicked on a couple of times and it fell to Benzema centrally, edge of the 6-yard box, and people all around him, very crowded, and just in that very classy way that strikers at his level do. He computed the situation instantly, so chested the ball up as opposed to trying to take it down, and swiveled, got his body in a good position and volleyed it into the roof of the net from 6 yards. Very classy goal, and it was 1-1 at half-time. So second half has just started. Intriguing game thus far. Now to Arsenal, on the back of the European Super League, obviously protests on Friday night outside the Emirates, huge protests. Wanted to pick the brain of Andrew Mangan of Arsblog and just get a sense of the Kroenke era. We're talking a lot about the Glazers and talking about Henry at Liverpool and Sheikh Mansour and I guess Abramovich a little bit, but Kroenke has lived up to his billing as Silent Stan. First came on board as a shareholder back in 07, majority shareholder by 2011, and as of 2018 owns 100% of the club. So he's been around a while now. Arsenal finished 8th last year. The post-Wenger era has not been good. We know he doesn't put money of his own into the club, but Arsenal are worth 2 billion and should have enough money to do okay or better than they're doing. So decided to pick the brain of Andrew Mangan about the Kroenke era. I started by telling him that I don't really associate the Emirates with protests under, you know, across the Kroenke era, but certainly nothing like the ones we saw on Friday.
I think there have been some small ones. There have been some signs and demonstrations, but I don't think there's ever been a protest of that size aimed specifically at the owners before. This was certainly the largest anti-KSE/Kroenke protest that there has been from Arsenal fans in the time that they've been at the club and in the time since they took full control back in 2018.
So the Kroenke era begins in 2007 when he first becomes a shareholder. Mm. He's on the board of directors 08 and he becomes majority shareholder 10 years ago this month, actually, takes 62% and then ultimately buys out Usmanov's 30% back in 2018. So that's been his rise over the last decade or so. Was he ever popular to begin with? Did people like what he was bringing to the party initially?
It's a weird one because when he arrived first, you know, he was brought in by David Dean. It was David Dean who brought in Stan Kroenke and did it in such a ham-fisted way. It cost David Dean his job at the club. And there was that famous quote from Peter Hillwood where he said, we don't want his sort in our game, something along those lines anyway, referring to Kroenke and an American sports owner, I think he was talking about. Was he ever popular? No, I don't think so. But I think what there was, because of this power struggle between Kroenke and Usmanov, there was a sense that at the time Kroenke would be the best owner because he was going to be this hands-off guy. This was, you have to remember, Arsene Wenger was still very powerful. He was the man who ran the football club. And as far as Kroenke was aware, and you know, it's the way he still operates, is he delegates or he lets people run the football club, for better or worse. And you know, we could talk maybe about the people that he's had in charge. But I think there was a sense that, you know, let things run the way they were running under Arsene Wenger. He had control. Nobody wanted an owner sticking their nose in or anything like that. So over time, he has become less popular. Part of the Arsene Wenger, the end of that reign, I think I should say is a better word. People were frustrated with Arsene Wenger, and there was a sense maybe that Kroenke let things go too long. There was the new contract given to him in 2017 after Arsenal won the FA Cup, and many people thought that would have been a good time to cut ties and let it end naturally. So his unpopularity has certainly grown over time, and when he took over fully 100%, when Usmanov sold up, nobody was really expecting Usmanov to do that. You know, he then became, I'm not going to say enemy number one, but there's nobody else involved. So he was calling the shots, and he ultimately is the guy at the top of the club who people have expressed their frustrations about.
Yes. Remind me of the David Dean situation. Dean, I would have thought, has impeccable credentials with the Arsenal fans, or does he?
For some, he does, because, you know, he did amazing work with Arsene Wenger.
Yeah.
But it was Dean who first approach Kroenke to buy shares that were owned at the time by Granada. I think Granada owned something like 9.9% of Arsenal. And Stan Kroenke was brought in to buy that shareholding. And there was the way it happened. I think the Arsenal board were caught by surprise, and David Dean paid for that with his job. And then David Dean went out and found Ali Shahrouzmanoff and set up another holding company. It was called Red and White Holdings. They bought up some Arsenal shares, and that's why we had this kind of footballing cold war, if you like, between the American and the oligarch for so long at Arsenal. These were both people that David Dean brought to the club. You know, he saw what was happening with Roman Abramovich and felt that Arsenal needed to have the injection of extra money to compete in the transfer market. And he probably wasn't wrong about that, but the way it happened, you know, it didn't really play out particularly well. So, look, there are some people who can recognize that what David Dean did in his time at Arsenal alongside Arsene Wenger, it was at the most successful period many of us have ever seen. But it sort of precipitated this really unhealthy ownership scenario where Usmanov was frozen out. And ultimately, because he realized Kroenke wasn't going to go anywhere, he sold.
Yes, so Kroenke had 62% of the club. Usmanov had the other 30-odd percent, give or take.
Well, and how there were smaller shareholders, sure, as well. You have to remember, and when one of the reasons why Kroenke's popularity declined greatly was because when he got to a certain point, he could buy out all the shares of the club. Company law allowed him to snaffle up. And there were a lot of long-term legacy shareholder shares that have been passed down from grandfather to father to grandson, those kind of things.
Right.
And the way it was done, there was no real acknowledgement that these weren't necessarily shares that people were holding on to for monetary value. They were very, very much for emotional value as much as anything, even if they were very valuable.
Right, interesting. And can you remember, and we're talking bluntly here, I presume, if Kroenke is very much Silent Stan and lives up to his billing and stays well away from things, did Usmanov bill himself as, I'll be free spending, I'll put billions into this team and turn you into a giant of European football? Or do you suspect he was very much in it for profit as well?
Well, I think probably the two guys are very different. You know, Kroenke is a sports owner. He owns the LA Rams and all the teams that he has in the US. And, you know, he has 5 or 6 franchises and Arsenal. Usmanov, I think you would put him more along the lines of the Abramovich, PSG, Man City owners who are looking to enhance their own reputation by owning a football club. I think there were incompatibilities there, obviously, between the two men in terms of their own outlook on how sports should be run. Usmanov was very quick to criticize at times. He came out when things weren't going well. And, you know, people, when things aren't going well, look to... It's like politics in a way, isn't it? That when the country's in a mess, the opposition looks great. Mm. So there was an element of that with Usmanov. And I think he did suggest that he certainly would spend, and he definitely had the money to spend, to invest. But this was at the time when Arsenal were very much preaching the self-sustaining model. There was a hope that FFP would be in some way useful instead of completely useless. So the club was being run in a specific way, and that suited Kroenke more than anyone, because it wasn't a situation where he had to put his hand in his own pocket to fund transfers and those kind of things. So there was always the view from the sideline, if you like, from Usmanov. He probably would have spent money if he'd been the guy who was solely in charge, but it's hard to know 100%, you know, how much of that is true and how much was just him talking, because, you know, it was easy for him to say the things that people wanted to hear.
Oh, absolutely. Campaign and poetry and all that.
Yeah, exactly.
We now have a decade of Kroenke as the controlling owner of the club, and last, 3-4 years, he has total control, 100%. Yeah. Ownership. We were talking about this on the news round just the other night, so it wasn't an appropriate way to get deeply into this. But one of the reasons I said it'd be great to talk to you is I was making the point last week that much of the fallout had focused on the Glazers, you know, and Neville, Gary Neville, had really led that charge. But I suspected actually the Kroenkes could be the one that could really face the ire of their own fans, because the Glazers, for all their ills, for all they've taken out of the club, they're still dropping 80 million on a Harry Maguire. They're still spending 60 million on Fernandes. They haven't allowed things just drift into mediocrity. Even though it's not quite their money they're spending, they are still spending some money. Whereas Arsenal last year finished eighth, which was horrific. This year they're, I don't know, last time I looked, somewhere around 10th, and drifting very solidly into mediocrity for the coming years. So that will be deeply, deeply unpopular. And then, lo and behold, there was the protest on Friday. But my throwaway line, and I want to get your sense of how true this is, my throwaway line in the news round was, well, I suspect Arsenal fans must have been deeply unhappy with Kroenke for a number of years, but, I mean, how much do they care? And that was a clumsy way of trying to get at the fact that there would be a perception of the well-heeled City banker, London supporter, who would like Arsenal to win, but isn't going to take to the streets either if things aren't going so well. What's your sense of that, on maybe the lack of disquiet or protest that we may have seen at other clubs if they had, you know, declined in this way?
It's an interesting question. I mean, just to come back to the money thing, I think, you know, it's a bit of a misnomer to think that Arsenal haven't spent money.
True.
Because they have.
True.
And last summer, after finishing eighth, the club spent £50 million on Thomas Partey. They paid out his 50 million euro, actually, his release clause to Atletico Madrid, which had to be paid in one go for it to work. So, you know, Kroenkes, whether they, I don't quite know how they did it, but the word is that they helped finance that deal. They also signed Gabriel from Ligue 1, who cost the guts of 30 million as well. You can go back and look at transfers that Arsenal have made, and Arsenal have spent quite a lot of money. I think the issue for Arsenal really is that the money that they've spent hasn't been spent particularly well, and they've let a lot of money walk out the door. A load of money walk out the door for absolutely nothing.
And sorry to interrupt, just to actually strengthen your argument, I just had a glance to see what are their top transfers, and a lot of them are all in the Kroenke era and relatively recently. Nicolas Pepe, that's 72 million sterling that you won't get back, August 2019. Aubameyang, 57 million in January 18. So that's the year Kroenke gets full control, but he's already very much the boss anyway. Lacazette, 50 million. Thomas Partey, as he said, 50 million. Ozil goes back to 2013, but they weren't afraid to pay big wages to keep him. Yeah. So yeah, I take your point on the spending. So is it more mismanagement than a certain frugality? Yeah.
I think it is. You know, it's a combination of things. Obviously, what's happening this season is not good enough from an Arsenal perspective, and that is playing very strongly into this, because, You know, I think people's satisfaction with the owners of their club is very, there's a direct correlation between how successful you are. And if Arsenal were cruising to the top four and, you know, still in Europe or whatever it was, you know, I don't think there would be quite the level of vociferousness to the protest, which isn't to say that people's objections to the Europa League weren't very strongly felt, because they were. Mm. But where we are is playing a really big part in what's happening. You know, it's, the season has been hugely disappointing. So, you know, there are a number of things, and the absenteeism, a sense that that KSE, and we talk about Stan Kroenke, but it's basically Josh Kroenke who is the KSE guy at Arsenal now, because Stan is very much involved in the LA Rams project and the stadium there and everything else. So Josh is the one that has been public facing. And I think what's one of the most interesting things about this is that a couple of summers ago, there was a campaign from Arsenal fans just sort of putting it up to the owners, like it was called We Care Do You. And it sparked a response from the owners, from Josh Kroenke, who met fan groups, he did interviews, he promised to engage more and all those kind of things. And there were some attempts on behalf of KSE to be a bit more transparent, a bit more open with fans. And this, of course, has completely undone all of that. You know, I'm not saying they got everybody on side or anything like that, but I think there was genuinely, A, because there's an acceptance that KSE aren't going anywhere, so B, if we can build some bridges and the communication is better and they can talk to us a bit more, that's a good thing. That's a positive thing, but it's really been undone by what's happened in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. I guess when you reflect on how it all happened, there was a lot of muddying of the waters. This wasn't straightforward. So, as you said, you've got the Usmanov versus Kroenke thing going on, so that's going to cause its own level of dysfunction. And then, like with Ferguson at Manchester United, the Wenger era is unique, really, in modern football. So once he goes, there's this huge vacuum that has to be filled. Your sense of how that has been filled, because, you know, just trying to keep track of everything which has gone on there, Edu is in there now as technical director. There was Gazidis who left for Milan. That was in 2018. There was Raul Sagnelli, director of football, who left. And see, I remember, Andrew, when Sven Mislintat arrived as head of recruitment and ultimately only lasted 14 months. And he left February 2019. That felt very much part of the Wenger going vacuum fallout. But he was billed as, you know, this is the guy who discovered X and Y and Z. He is going to revolutionise Arsenal. It's a bit like what Liverpool have done with their transfer committee. This is the post-Wenger era getting up to a very exciting start. And obviously, as I said, he only lasted 14 months. So this vacuum that Wenger leaves in the same year that Usmanov is turfed out effectively, and then they haven't handled that, it seems, very well. Maybe understandably, because it's probably difficult to handle. But what's your sense of those 3 years post-Wenger and trying to move different pieces across this chessboard behind the scenes? A lot of power grabbing and politicking, I suspect.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was always going to be a difficult transition from the Wenger era to the post-Wenger era, because you were having to do something completely different. Wenger was a manager who had control over so much at the club, and that's not the way managers operate these days, not the way head coaches operate. They don't want to do all that kind of stuff. So you have to go with a different model. And I mean, look, the appointment of Unai Emery was a surprise. It was, it's not one that still makes a great deal of sense to me, given what had happened and how it happened. But, you know, at least there was this structure put in place where Gazidis was going to be the chief executive. They had Raul Sagnelli, who was like the head of football operations, something like that. And Sven Mislintat was going to be the head of recruitment. And that trio was going to work together to support the head coach, which was then Unai Emery. So on paper, you could say that's a reasonable setup. Gazidis had the experience, had been there for years. Sagnelli was the kind of mover shaker guy who could get deals done. And Mislintat was going to find the talent. Emery then has to do the business on the pitch. But Gazidis then left for AC Milan after a couple of months. Raul Sagnelli was appointed as head of football. He immediately got rid of Sven Mislintat. I know all these things are presented as mutual, but, you know, there was a power struggle and he came out on top. That's the reality of that situation.
Right.
So now super agents start getting involved in Arsenal's transfer business. Nicolas Pepe, as you say, £72 million. George Mendes is involved. Kia Jurabchian, all of a sudden Arsenal are signing players all over the place who are represented by Kia Jurabchian. You know, I think when you, I got to be careful with how I say this, but I think you leave yourself vulnerable to opportunists when you just put people in charge without sufficient oversight. And I feel that's what happened with KSE. And that's what happened in that period of 18 months, 2 years after Wenger left and Unai Emery got fired. They were vulnerable to people who were, you know, you can ask, were they acting in the best interest of Arsenal?
Mm.
And I can't tell you for sure that they weren't, but it's also hard for me to say that they were based on what happened and some of the things that happened, some of the deals that were done, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, KSE brought in a lawyer called Tim Lewis last year who worked with them on the takeover of Arsenal when they were doing the shares and everything else. And within 4 or 5 weeks of that guy coming in to have a look at what was going on, Raul saying, yeah, he was out the door on the eve of a new season, on the eve of, you know, in the middle of the most difficult transfer window that anybody has ever seen, they sack their, or they, the head of football, you know, leaves. So, you know, there have been a lot of things in the last little while that have gone wrong. And it's hard not to look at their, I'm going to say absenteeism, but their distance from the football club as a significant reason as to why that happened.
Yes, that they don't probably have a feel for the power relations and the various politicking which might be going on. What's your sense then, Andrew, now of who has a hold of the club now, or who has Josh Kroenke's ear now, or is there still maybe a vacuum?
No, I don't think there is. I think that, look, things have not been very good under Mikel Arteta this season, but he did win the FA Cup last season. I think, you know, criticism of Arsenal's performances this season are more than merited. I have a suspicion that Arteta's job could, not saying it definitely does, but it could depend on what happens in the Europa League. If Arsenal win it, I mean, it's an amazing thing to win a European trophy, which hasn't been done since 94, and then you get into next season's Champions League. I do think they have quite a bit of faith in Arteta and Edu to a lesser extent. Those guys, what I would say about Arteta is that the consistent message from him is that he knows things are wrong, things have got to be put right. You know, there's been a lot that's been bad at Arsenal for quite a long time. So you can't fix it overnight.
Mm.
You know, you even go back to just January when the club took out a loan from the Bank of England, which is due to be repaid in May. But, you know, a large part of that, it seems, was used to pay off players who, you know, were not contributing, who were potentially a bit of a clique on the training ground, not positive around the club. So, you know, Mesut Ozil left, Mustafi left, Kolasinac left, Socrates left. They basically paid these players to go away.
Mm.
So there are fairly radical things being done in as much as they can be done in this current climate to try and sort things out. But of course, the issue for Arteta is he's trying to do all this in tandem with producing results on the pitch, which are commensurate with the expectations that Arsenal Football Club should have. And unfortunately, in Premier League terms anyway, he hasn't been able to do that this season.
And are you optimistic enough to think that the getting rid of those more toxic elements is just a necessary growing pain at the moment, and this is ultimately a good thing, that, you know, those 3-4 years after Wenger left, well, I guess it's not even been that long, but that initial period after Wenger left where some costly mistakes were made, is your sense now that the club has sorted things out behind the scenes, Arteta is doing his best, they're paying off some of those players you mentioned, and they might re-emerge into next season and beyond on a better footing, or hard to know?
It's hard to know, to be perfectly honest. You know, the idea of taking a step backwards to take a step forwards again was not one that I was not averse to, but it wasn't unexpected that Arsenal were going to stumble a little bit before they found their feet again. It's just that we can't find our feet at the moment. You know, they are doing a lot of things. There's a guy coming in called Richard Garlick who's going to be added to the executive team along with Arteta, along with Edu, along with Per Mertesacker, who's the head of the academy, along with Vinay, who is the chief executive. It's a fairly young executive team. Inexperienced might be another way of putting it. I think what it boils down to for me is that somebody had to start putting things right. Somebody had to start trimming the bloated squad. Somebody had to sort of say, okay, we've got a line in the sand here. We really have to improve as a football club in everything that we do, culturally, you know, how we operate. Let's not let guys like Danny Welbeck, Aaron Ramsey, Alexis Sanchez, Santi Cazorla, Jack Wilshere. I'm sure there are others I've forgotten as well. But basically, Cazorla is a little bit different because it was an injury. But, you know, guys who are worth a lot of money went for free, for nothing.
Yeah.
Because the club just couldn't make decisions on when to sell these guys. Like, sometimes it hurts to sell a player. But sometimes you have to take that pain in order to get the money and reinvest and everything else. So there's a lot of things that they have to get on top of, you know.
Kind of amazing that was allowed to happen when, if you asked a lot of Arsenal fans, I suspect, about Kroenke, they would point to the fact he doesn't put his hands in his own pocket here and isn't shelling out big money for players and is, you know, somebody else could argue this is a sustainable model whereby the club will pay for itself, is his point of view, as opposed to ending up like Real Madrid and Barcelona. But it's funny that they allowed all that money to just flow out of the club like that if they're so on top of finances, supposedly.
Well, supposedly. You know, I think, you know, they have to have a reckoning about how they deal with players and player contracts. And, you know, it's difficult to know what the market is going to be like this summer and how much money is going to be around. You know, we've seen what's happened with this Super League thing and why the likes of Real Madrid and Barcelona are so desperate to get into it. And even Arsenal, you know, there was never in the 48 hours or 72 hours or however long it rumbled on, you know this, you covered it, I'm sure, as much as anyone. There was never from anyone any sporting justification as to why this thing was going ahead.
And is your sense of Kroenke, because I have a good feel for a lot of the other owners, especially in England, and, well, I guess Agnelli is fairly transparent and the Spanish club's transparent. I wasn't as sure with Kroenke. Like, it could have been everything from complete disinterest. Like, yeah, whatever, I'll go along with it. Like, is he a money man? Is he in this to make money and take money out of the club and flip this club for a couple of billion down the line, and we'll come to, you know, potential takeover. But is that your sense of Kroenke, that the attraction here is financial purely?
No, I don't think so. I think if you're a billionaire and you're looking to make money from football clubs, you're kind of in the wrong business, unless you are, you know, as you say, going to flip it somewhere down the line. I don't think that's necessarily what he wants to do. The message that has consistently come out from people who are in contact with KSE, and I think we had David Ornstein talking about this over the weekend, is that they do not sell. They have no intention of selling. They don't sell their assets. They don't sell their clubs or teams or franchises or however you want to call it. It might be a case that, you know, I feel like our Arsenal's involvement in the Super League was, you know, their justification was, we don't want to get left behind. But you know, what it does is it just ring fences the value of the club.
Is he taking big dividends out every year?
No, he hasn't, in fairness. Well, there were a couple of years where he took a consultancy fee.
Yeah. $3 million, though. That's nothing, you know.
$3 million a couple of years. But it went down badly because none of the shareholders previously had taken dividends, even if some of the shareholders then made a lot of money by selling their shares, of course, to Kroenke and or Usmanov, whoever it was that they sold to. So it's not like he is leeching 25, 30 million pounds a year out of the club. I don't know what that would do for Stan Kroenke's bank balance anyway.
It would just be
piffling. It'd be like you and me taking 50p out of the till. You know, it's not going to make him any richer than he already is. So I don't think this is a thing where the end game is you know, he's going to build the valuation of the club up and, you know, buy an island somewhere because he can sell Arsenal. He's already got a huge ranch. He's got everything he wants. You know what? This isn't about just making money for him. So, you know, that leads to the question, where do we go from here under Kroenke? But I think the bottom line, as far as I can see right now anyway, is that Kroenke isn't going anywhere.
Yeah. So that does suggest, because the Glazers, obviously, their intentions are obvious. That with Kroenke, that more suggests incompetency to explain the last couple of years. Because it's very easy to paint a narrative of Stan Kroenke is in this for the money. He's quite happy for Arsenal to just muddle somewhere mid-table Premier League where he doesn't have to spend a lot of his own money or any of his own money. And it's still an incredibly nice asset to have. And maybe he takes a bit of dividends here or there. That was kind of what I had been suspecting. But listening to you now, it doesn't sound like that. But then it's almost just drifting through incompetency and not getting a hold of the club and putting the right people in the right places, like, almost.
Yeah, I think, look, you're not too far off the mark when you say he thought that Arsenal was just going to drift along, because one of the things that Arsenal had under Arsene Wenger until right at the very end was huge consistency in terms of where they finished in the Premier League. It was always in the top four.
Yes,
always.
Yes.
And my sense is that Kroenke kind of was happy for that to just chug along. No question. I don't disagree with you in that sense. And I kind of wonder if he thought that was always going to be the case, that, like, you know, you couldn't envisage, for example, in Spain, Barcelona or Real Madrid finishing outside the top four, because they always are in the top four. They're, you know, champions or runners up. So I do wonder if Kroenke perhaps underestimated the competition in English football and what you need to do to remain competitive or to remain consistent. So I think he kind of thought it was always going to be like that. And in the last couple of years, they've, you know, I'm sure they've realized that there's a lot can happen in English football. You know, remember Chelsea finishing 12th one year. I know they went on to win the league the next year, but it can happen where, you know, you start to tumble backwards. And Arsenal have been going backwards. And particularly since Kroenke took 100% control, there is, you know, a direct trajectory from their 100% ownership and Arsenal's final league position in the Premier League. Now, it's a short sample size, I guess, in that it's only 2 or 3 years, but, you know, it's unmistakable at the same time. Yes. So the question now is, what are they going to do and how are they going to correct this and how are they going to make things better? And that remains to be seen.
Yes. Well, then a final point to leave off on is Daniel Ek, defender of Spotify, tweeting that he's cheered for Arsenal as long as he can remember. If KSE would like to sell Arsenal, I'd be happy to throw my hat in the ring. So he's several billion to his name, Swedish, worked at various tech companies. He set up Spotify and enjoys the finer things. Now, on his Arsenal fan routine, not that Twitter is everything, we can mistake it sometimes for everything, but if you just go by Twitter, this supposed Arsenal fan doesn't follow Arsenal or any of the players, and in well over a decade he tweeted about Arsenal twice. So his beloved Arsenal may just be more of a casual acquaintance. Your point ultimately, Andrew, is Kroenkes are showing no signs of people who want to sell. And I mean, even if the protests become a weekly thing and it all gets very ugly and there's boycotting of games, I mean, is that any of that business on the cards, or is it hard to know?
Well, it's hard to know. I don't think that will be the last protest, but look, Stan Kroenke moved the Rams from St. Louis to Los Angeles, which is the most hated man in that city, and he didn't care.
No.
He didn't care, so I don't quite know why this kind of protest would faze him. With regards to Daniel Ek thing, you know, it's hard to really lend it any credibility until we hear a bit more about it. You know,
it could be a publicity stunt. I mean, I've heard Spotify mentioned more times in the last 24 hours.
I mean, it's certainly been great for Spotify, you know, in terms of their PR and everything else. And when you get Dennis Bergkamp, Thierry Henry, Patrick Vieira supposedly involved in this, you know, we don't quite know what roles they would have. What Arsenal fan isn't going to say, well, that sounds great. A, it's not Kroenke. B, we've got ex-players that we love involved, and see, it's not Kroenke. But, you know, that's the kind of surface level thought that this thing has been given. You know, how does Daniel Ek raise the money for it? I mean, he's a rich enough guy, but, you know, to buy something from KSE that they don't want to sell, you're going to have to put all that money down. The valuation may well be £2 billion. What Stan Kroenke would be willing to sell it for is another matter entirely. Do you then have a club run by a guy who apparently is so enchanted by Arsenal that he spends his time in Spotify board meetings watching Arsenal games? Is that the guy that's going to run your club? Really? You know, I'm like Philippe, I'm very dubious as to the veracity of all this. I hear that he's supposed to speak tomorrow publicly about his plans. I think all this has been rushed off the back of the tweet that he put out over the weekend. I think some people have been in touch. They've, you know, sensed the public mood, whether they're serious. Maybe they are. I mean, you don't get this far, I suppose, in terms of the coverage if you're not a little bit serious. But look, Stan Kroenke is not known as Silent Stan for no reason whatsoever. I don't think if you want to buy Arsenal from Stan Kroenke, you get anywhere by doing it publicly first. You don't, you know, get it by doing an interview with Sky Sports or a tweet that gets everybody crazy. That's not what's going to make Stan Kroenke amenable to your offer, if you can even make one. So I'm really, really dubious about this. And the other point as well is that, like, you know, if anything has come out of this European Super League thing, surely the push from football fans should be some fundamental change to the way football clubs are owned and run. We hear about the German model. We hear about fan involvement, 50+1, all of those things. Just swapping one bad billionaire for one you know that isn't quite as bad until you get to know him, I'm not sure that's the sustainable way of doing things either.
No, I agree. I think there's a increasingly thin belief that a billionaire will come in and buy you Mbappe and everything will be all right. And it's not the way it's working increasingly. Andrew, that was fantastic. Great to really get your sense of the last decade or so at Arsenal, get a feel for what's going on with the Kroenkes. Really appreciate it. Andrew Mankin of Arsblog. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Cheers, Joe.
Now, just to update you on events over in Madrid, 1-1 with 83 minutes on the clock.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise? The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Hey folks, you're welcome back. Still 1-1 between Madrid and Chelsea, 85 minutes on the clock. Pulisic and Benzema with the goals. We are going stateside to Jeff Reuter, North American football coverage for The Athletic. Jeff, how you doing?
Doing all right. Thanks for having me.
No, great to have you with us. We wanted to touch on the Neville Beckham dynasty, which is kicking off the MLS season underway. Yeah. Am I right in saying, just as a first off and as an insight into the, I suppose, intelligence around Beckham and everything he did, that when he signed for LA Galaxy in 07, there was a clause in his contract which allowed him to buy an MLS franchise effectively for $25 million, which is a steal. I'm right in saying it's a steal as well.
Oh, it's an absolute steal. These days, the fees are starting at $300 million American dollars, and they're working their way up. There's a chance that by the time this league inevitably grows to 31 and 32 clubs, that you're looking much closer to $500 million American dollars. So to get one for $25 million has been possibly the most valuable part of that contract that Beckham signed when he left Real Madrid in 2007.
Wow. There's no flies on him.
No, none whatsoever.
The situation with the home stadium, I understand, is ongoing. Inter Miami in existence for about 3 years now at this stage. Is it that they can't get a home stadium, or they're close to it, or how's it been going?
Yeah, there's been some false starts here, some near misses. I think that they've looked at the top priority with the stadium project to be within Miami proper, to get out of the broader county, to make sure that it is something that people could go to, whether it's via mass transit, bicycle, driving, what have you, rather than make it that sort of soccer moms and soccer dads driving the van full of children out into the suburbs. Right now they are playing at something of a historic venue called Lockhart Stadium, which was the Fort Lauderdale Strikers Stadium, an old NASL club. They had to retrofit it, turn it pink essentially, and then they've been playing there ever since. Will that be their permanent home? Ideally, if you're asking the club, it won't be. They will be able to find a way to get into Miami. They want something that's oceanfront ideally. However, I mean, look, New York City FC has been running into stadium issues as well for 6, 7, 8 years now, being located in Yankee Stadium. And even now they're playing games in the rival New York Red Bulls. When you're building in these major cities, like Major League Soccer wants to be doing, they're not just going to hand you parcels of land and say, here you go, go build us a 20,000, 25,000 foot or 25,000 capacity stadium. They're, you know, you have to go through the exact process that everyone else would. Mm. And I think at this point, American sports is seeing stadium fatigue, because every NFL team has wanted a new stadium over the last 10, 15 years, every Major League Baseball team. So to be trying to ask for land for a specific soccer stadium when soccer is still growing in the United States, it still is not nearly to what the NFL is. It's a big ask for any market.
Yes, I was just reading how the Glazers recently managed to get the good people of Tampa to basically pay for their stadium. So I can imagine the fatigue.
That's right.
No shock as to why Beckham picked Miami. I mean, nice part of the world to spend your time, I suspect. And also a ripe South American football mad audience, presumably.
Yeah, a lot of Cubans as well, and just a lot of Latin American influence in that market. I think that they look at it as potentially vibrant. I mean, the branding, they certainly went hoping that it would be something that would really take off. I think black and pink is something that you choose with marketability in mind. It's not something you stumble upon because you think it's going to, you know, clash less with the opponent's kits, right? Mm. So I certainly think that they've expected it to take off more than it has. If I'm being completely honest with you, I think that the stadium has been harder to come by than they expected. I think that the on-field product has not lived up to their expectations. It's why you saw so much overhaul within the sporting department on the football side over the last offseason, where they fired the manager, they fired the sporting director, they fired the chief scout, the technical director, and brought in fresh faces. Of course, Phil Neville, the most notable one. Chris Henderson, for American fans, they'll recognize him as being the architect of the dynasty ongoing for the Seattle Sounders. But there's a lot of bad pieces, admittedly, to this club right now. I think that there's a lot of mismanagement of resources from the start that they've been really trying to dig out of, a lot of multi-year contracts to players who should not have had them. Multi-year contracts are maybe a little more rare in Major League Soccer than they would be in most of Europe. For the most part, you are able to get players to sign one-year guarantees and have club options tacked onto the end. You know, and so like a rookie, for example, drafted will have a one-year guarantee and three club options. Mm. That's just standard practice. And so they don't have many of those players. Instead, they have the Blaise Matuidis, where they're stuck on that contract and he is getting run past like a slalom course right now in Major League Soccer. And that's just the reality of it. And they're stuck with that for probably another 2 years.
Okay. Gonzalo Higuain is there, I guess, another high-profile player. Phil Neville got his first win at the weekend. They're two games into the season. They beat Philadelphia Union 2-1. I think, was it 10th, Jeff, they finished last year?
10th in the East, that's right.
Yeah, 10th in the East, which isn't anything to write home about, especially. And I think it will be more difficult to make the playoffs this season. Are they equipped, or are they likely to do anything particularly special this season, barring a Phil Neville miracle?
Hey, well, that's just it. You're asking for a Phil Neville miracle. You're asking for a Gonzalo Higuain miracle, a Blaise Matuidi miracle. You're hoping somebody comes out of the woodwork. You're putting a lot of pressure, actually, on the legs of Kieran Gibbs and Ryan Shawcross, because right now the weakest part of that team is its defense. And the reinforcements that they have gone out for are old boys that, frankly, I think that a lot of fans of mid to lower table championship clubs wouldn't be thrilled to see coming in as the reinforcements to be the starter. You know, no disrespect to the careers that they've had, but I'm not sure they're necessarily moving the needle in the same way. Ryan Shawcross did an interview where he said he was literally about to retire until he got a call to come and play in the MLS. And if that isn't the running joke about Major League Soccer, I'm not sure what is. Yeah, I mean, look, they were about 18th out of 26 teams in Major League Soccer last year. That is absurd. You know, that's appalling. That's not going to be what they expected. That's not the level that they want to establish themselves into. So as for this year, I mean, they've got Lewis Morgan, who's fared very well for them last year, and I think that he'll be a key contributor this year. Rodolfo Pizarro has also been probably their best player since he left Club Monterrey to be able to join Inter Miami. But I think that I'm looking at the Eastern Conference, and assuming the postseason is what MLS's usual is, which is to say seven clubs per conference, I think I'm seeing seven or eight clubs that seem more likely to be in those playoff positions than Inter Miami. It'll just come down to the individual brilliance of some of these attackers that we've spoken about. And if they're able to steal a point or three here or there, that can make all the difference.
And what's your sense of Beckham in all this, Jeff? What's his ambition and motivation in all this?
Yeah, I think at first he trusted the people that he had helped appoint. I think that, the, as I said, the manager, the sporting director, the technical director, the scout, who have all since moved on, made a lot of decisions he didn't agree with, but he was very hands-off for that first year. And the perception stateside has been that Beckham has had a much more hands-on role in this lead-up to the 2021 MLS season. He, of course, bringing in Neville, it's pretty hard to look at that and say that would be the Moss brothers, the other owners of the club who would be looking to do that. Of course, that has David Beckham's DNA all over it. But, you know, you look at a couple of the other players that they have brought in. You look at bringing in Mark Prezant to be in as a technical director, a former North American scout for Manchester United. There's a connection there again. So I believe that he has really been looking to save face to make sure that it doesn't become a punchline. It doesn't become a club that is an easy target, both domestically and frankly, more so abroad, as the joke of, okay, well, here's the footballer who's trying to live out his dreams and failing miserably, right? And, you know, how many football manager saves have we all had that have fared much better than this club has? So I think that he's been looking to reestablish it. It's very difficult. Frankly, it's very expensive, all of the overhaul that they've had to put in to dig out of those initial mistakes. But I do think that he does have the ambition to make Miami a permanent force for consideration for titles within Major League Soccer moving forward.
How popular is the MLS these days?
It is, as far as ticket sales goes, look, there's a lot of metrics that you could look at, right? I think in far as ticket sales go, it tends to outgross ice hockey, basketball, but that's arenas, right? Because they're all indoors. So they're usually 18 to 20,000 seats, but even Major League Baseball, the ratings, television ratings fluctuate depending on what was the lead in, what's coming next. If you're playing right after a World Cup game, it's going to be much better than if you're coming after Days of Our Lives, a soap opera that's been running in the States forever. But, you know, it is growing. I think that the fact they were able to continue to play through the pandemic with just a 2 or 3 month layoff in the spring in 2020 really did them wonders in terms of having a consistent presence on ESPN, which is essentially their main broadcast partner, to be able to have that sort of content, to be able to have greater prominence within North American sports as well, because make no mistake about it, for 25 years, it has been the fifth of five leagues in terms of men's sports in the United States and Canada. But I think that it has gotten to the point where it is in conversation of eclipsing the NHL. It is probably in conversation with Major League Baseball in terms of the trajectory each league has been on over the last 10 years. It's more popular. I will say that the average American soccer fan is probably more into international football. They're probably watching the Premier League. They're waking up early to you know, be able to have their Guinnesses at 9 a.m., what have you, to watch a kickoff of Southampton. But I believe that MLS is also growing, just maybe at a slower rate than the international audience is.
Okay, very interesting. Jeff Reuter from The Athletic. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Yeah, anytime.
Appreciate it. So Jeff Reuter there from The Athletic covers North American soccer there. It's finished 1-1 in Madrid.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network.